Hello, and welcome to the ABC's Green Politics, a podcast which is part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. I'm Linda Sullivan, and I'll be your host for this episode, which is actually a two-parter. I've just come on board as a co-host of this podcast, so you'll bear with me, I hope, as I find my feet and learn the podcast name. If you've just stumbled across this episode, you may well guess from the title that we're working our way down the alphabet with all things green and political with a small p, and that we've arrived at O. So O is for optimism, something that could be a bit controversial and definitely more scarce as we free fall deeper and deeper into the multi-crisis world of today. So is optimism still possible? Is it responsible? And how does optimism differ from hope, and in particular active hope, a concept I'm rather fond of myself and that we'll be talking about? My two guests are two women I've met and organised with in my own activism, two inspiring figures from the Americas. I couldn't get them together due to time zone differences and busy schedules, so I first spoke to Mariana Gomez, a Colombian anti-mining activist who also works with Gaia Amazonas, and will tell us a wee bit about her involvement in the recent COP15, the often forgotten one on biodiversity, the so-called Nature COP. I then had a conversation with Anne Simmons-Booker, who's the main support to Joanna Macy, the founder of the practice called Active Hope and the work that reconnects, as well as being a facilitator and teacher herself. So I've put them into two parts. All right, enough for me. Hope you enjoy. Okay, so thanks for joining us, Anne. And yeah, could we just maybe start with talking a bit about the work that you do, particularly like work like the Active Hope work. So I suppose over the years, the work that I would know as Active Hope has changed, I suppose, like in, well, for a start with the title. So it used to be called Hope and Despair in the Nuclear Age, and then the work that reconnects, and then now the most recent version of Active Hope. So I suppose, what are the importance of those words in those contexts, and then how did you first get involved?
Thank you, Linda. It's so lovely to be able to have this conversation with you. So the work emerged from the life and work of the root teacher, Joanna Macy. And she was inspired, or really woke up to the issue of nuclear waste when her son wrote a paper in college and shared it with her. And she just thought, wow, if people understood the significance of this problem, the seriousness of this problem, that we have created all this waste material, we don't know what to do with it. It's going to be here into eternity. It's highly dangerous and toxic and radioactive. People would want to do something about it. And so she started to get her activism, you know, deepened around this issue. And when she got people talking about it, just together to talk about it, she noticed that that was something that started to be transformative, because there was, people were in a lot of denial. So in a lot of ways, she stepped into the work coming through her around that nuclear issue. So the body of work in her first book was Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age, because that was really the work she was doing and the topic at the time that was mattering most to her, which it still does, I want to say. And the nuclear threat certainly has not gone away and has become significantly more dangerous, really. And it's part of the reason it's more dangerous is because kind of collectively, we don't think about it anymore. It's almost like it's climate change for activists, you know, has replaced nuclear everything. And we fail kind of collectively to make those connections and even have brought nuclear power back as a viable solution because of climate change. So that's a whole other conversation. But that was sort of the container where her work started. And so in those early years, you know, what she found was people didn't want to talk about it. You know, they did not want to talk about it. And so she was curious about why is that? And so as she started developing group work where people could hear their own voice and hear each other, she started to see that that was transformative. And so the next way that it got named was deep ecology. So that was the time, you know, when Arnie Ness and others were, you know, that the whole idea of the ecological awareness we were waking up to, and it was starting to become an overarching issue as well, that, you know, the earth is, we're killing the planet and we need to tend to this. And so again, through her own life and work and personal experiences and the people that she was connecting to and traveling at that point. And so it felt like it made sense to call it deep ecology work. And then it sort of outgrew that title as well at a certain moment. And she tells the story about being with her, the co-author of the book, Coming Back to Life, which is the book that she wrote with Molly Brown to describe the process and these practices and give the practices themselves for other people to do. And they were with her husband, Fran. And the question was, well, you know, what could we call this work? Because it felt like it had outgrown the Deep Ecology title. And Fran said, well, you know, what does this work do? It tends to reconnect us. It helps us to reconnect. They were all agreeing, yes. And so then he said, well, what about the work that reconnects? And so that's how that title emerged from the body of work. So Active Hope then was really Chris Johnstone's collaboration with Joanna Macy. And Chris being a facilitator of the work in the UK and a medical doctor and someone who really took Joanna's work. A lot of people have done this, you know, because Joanna gave the work away, which was a brilliant thing. She wanted the work to be out there in the world. So she gave it away and everybody's had the beautiful challenge of figuring out how to make it their own because, you know, this it's archetypal in some ways, but you have to bring your own flavor and your own life experience into it to, you know, to ground it and to make it what it is. So Chris's way of doing that and his way of teaching the work, you know, really in a collaboration with Joanna resulted in the book Active Hope. So, and then places like some places in the UK, like in Ireland, adopted that title and called the work that. And so like in Germany, they still call it Deep Ecology work. So they never really switched to the work that reconnects. So it just kind of shows the diversity of how things can adapt in different contexts and cultures. And, you know, the name that works or reflects it, you know, is comes out of that particular ecosystem, if you will.
Yeah, I like that, the fact that it's open source, you know, it's what makes what we know as Active Hope so appealing. The main
yes.
It is open source, and like you have all these practices that you have to pay a lot of money to become a facilitator, and you know it's quite inaccessible to many people. But Active Hope, you know, if you've read the book and you've connected with people and you kind of feel confident yourself in holding a workshop, you know, then you can. You know, it's not like you need a certificate or whatever. No, I think for me that was important.
Yes. And I'm curious to know how it has been taking hold more in Ireland, because it was 2019 when I was there with you. And, you know, there was the facilitation development program. And so what's your sense of how it's going there in the island?
Yeah, well, we formed just around the time that you came to visit us then, we formed the Active Hope Ireland Network. And I suppose before that, there'd been some seeds there, you know, with different people finding Active Hope through different channels. And then when you came, like, we had that wonderful weekend in Wicklow, and it was all people who wanted to develop the practice, maybe for the first time, maybe you know, getting better at being a facilitator. And so from that, then we met every month as a group of people who wanted to continue the practice. And that was really great, you know, to have that support, because then, you know, we would go away and do our own workshops in our own communities or, you know, areas of influence, and then come back and share how it went, you know, get advice and whatever. And also, like, practice doing it badly as well, you know, practice making mistakes. And
sure,
we could, you know, like, in that supportive space where people would tell you kind of in an open and but critical way, you know, how maybe it could be done differently or done better or whatever. So yeah, I really appreciated the having that network. And me personally, I've done some workshops with, you know, like Extinction Rebellion and Friends of the Earth, and you know, some young people up in Derry, like with Park Youth. So I think for me, I had started doing the in-person workshops, which I really find, you know, like every time it's different and really rich. And then COVID hit and it was like,
yes.
No, yeah. We can't do this online, you know, just didn't want to go there and didn't for a while. And then I think it was Extinction Rebellion again asked me to do it online, and I thought I'd try, and it was okay.
Yeah,
it was more than okay. It wasn't the same, but it was different. In that difference came something else, you know.
Yes, I think a lot of people had that same experience, of finding it didn't seem like it could happen, but then it did, and it was rich and it worked.
Yeah. And also you could reach people like geographically wider.
Sure.
And people maybe that couldn't have traveled to where you were.
Yes.
And, you know, so it really opened doors that way.
Yes.
Accessibility of it. You know?
Yeah. And so that's still going on then. And the network is still, people are still connecting and.
Yes. And it did take a wee bit of a dip there for some reason. I think just like it has come on waves, you know.
Sure.
And
sure.
It was on a bit of a dip there. But just last week, there was a message came through and another kind of workshop that was happening. And so that stimulated the discussion again. And so it's there. It's still there. But I think we'd like to get everyone together again in person, you know, for that.
Sure.
Boost.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And also when you were here, you came with us to the communities in the Hesperians and in Derry. You know, so how was that for you, and how was it then practicing something that you have like all that rich experience with, but like here in Ireland, you know, because of Irish roots yourself?
Oh, well, it was so moving to be there, you know, on that trip with you, and so grateful for, you know, that you organized those spots. And I, as somebody with Irish roots who's still trying to figure out exactly from where, I always love coming to Ireland, and being able to do the work that reconnects in Ireland is sort of like the, as good as it gets for me. It's so incredibly meaningful because for me personally, as a facilitator, you know, you just mentioned every time you do it, it's different and it's always rich, and it's, there's always healing and things that, you know, as a facilitator and somebody, when you facilitate the work, you are in it. You're not just sort of it, you know, you're in it as you facilitate. So you're a facilitator and a participant at the same time. And being in Ireland and my own work of healing ancestral trauma and reconnecting to land. And since I'm pretty 100% sure through more like intuitive ways of knowing and maybe things like, well, O'Neill is a clan name that would have been from that part of the island. To be in that part of the island with you and to travel around was very meaningful for me in terms of the places we visited and just even my own activism. It was extraordinary, and I hope to be able to come again, truly.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. And as well, I suppose, thinking of what's happening in the US at the minute, with stripping back of rights, like reproductive rights, and, you know, the far right, not just in the US, obviously, the rise of the far right, but like when you see all that happening with climate breakdown, you know, with the sixth mass extinction, with like all these, you know, war profiteering as well, like I suppose there has been times in history that have been also very scary, but we just seem to be on a different level now. So how do you retain that hope? And I suppose, how do you compare hope with optimism, you know, because I suppose,
yeah,
this podcast is called Over Optimism because we got to that letter in the alphabet. But
sure,
you know, optimism, I suppose what I would say is, you know, expecting a good outcome, whereas hope, and especially active hope, like doesn't rely on that good outcome.
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. It's very rich for me. And I love the idea that active hope is about doing, you know, that hope, you know, we could think of hope as something that flows through us. It's, you know, a feeling, or it's a need we have to be able to hope. And one of the teachings of Joanna about gratitude is that it doesn't depend on external circumstances. So we can put our attention there even when we're not feeling grateful, or even when our circumstances are not what we would want. And I think that extends to hope. You know, we can choose hope even when our circumstances, you know, seem dire or less than hopeful. And that matters a lot to me because I do have power over where I put my attention, you know, in the context of all the things you just named, where a lot of feelings of powerlessness can arise and do, for sure. There is still a place where I have a choice of where to put my attention and where to exercise my power. So it's something that I keep choosing, and I don't need to feel hopeful in order to choose to act on behalf of life. I need to be resourced with my purpose and my meaning and my understanding of why I'm here and what is mine to do. And so hope is sort of superfluous to that. Like if I'm feeling hopeful, it's nice and it kind of gives me some energy, but I can continue on the path of what I'm here to do even without that feeling. I agree with you that we are in circumstances that are pretty unique in the, you know, historical journey of the human journey here, able to actually destroy the entire planet. And also the paradox of it is, you know, for other people who have lived and faced huge, you know, huge challenges, it wouldn't have made a difference to them to make a distinction about whether the whole planet was going to be destroyed or just the world they were in, right? When just thinking about just the terrible suffering and all of the wars and all of the, you know, plagues and the things that have ravaged people for so long. So there is that paradox again of, you know, how do we hold all that and still take the next step, which I find is a helpful way to proceed. And I love to quote the poet David White, you know, his poem, Start Close In, you know, so it's just about how do I start close in and just take the next step? So when I'm feeling less than optimistic or when I'm not feeling hopeful, what's the next step for me that gets me back on the path of purpose? Because it's just worth doing. It's worth being alive and worth doing what I came here to do, whether or not anything that I do is going to change anything or whether or not I succeed. So, you know, again, I don't want to throw all that out either, because it's important to be able to rally my energy and my capacity towards something that is moving us toward a place we want to go, right? I think of Cesar Chavez, the great farm worker organized nonviolent activist. I heard him speak years ago, and he was talking about, you know, the difference between sort of faithfulness and effectiveness. And often in the world in which I was in, you know, we would quote Mother Teresa that we're not trying to be successful here. What matters is to be faithful. And then I heard him basically say the opposite. You know, it does matter for us to be successful, because if we are not successful, it's the poor who are suffering. So it does matter. And I thought, well, that's so interesting, right? And then for me, whenever I don't like the extremes of one thing or the other, I'm like, okay, what's the third way? And obviously it doesn't have to be an either or, it's a both and. So both things matter. It matters to be faithful, even when we can't see the outcome. You know, what's in front of us is so unclear and so uncertain that we don't know if our actions are going to make a difference. It's important to be in those moments. And it's also important, you know, to be effective and to take actions that are going to move us toward the world we want to create, because, you know, the very future of the planet and our species is on the line. So both things can be true at the same time. Did that begin to answer your question, Linda?
Yeah, no, it did. Yeah. Thank you for that. And you were talking about, you know, being resourced as well. Like, so I suppose personally then, what resources you whenever you're at a low point or whenever you're, you know, need that bit of lifting out of that space, you know, like what resources do you turn to?
So I think that I've been given this idea by my mentor, Mickey Kashtan, about capacity. And it's a lens through which I can see a lot of things now. Like, do I actually have the capacity to take this on? And our capacity waxes and wanes, right? And so it's important to pay attention to it. And sometimes we have to keep stretching past our capacity because the circumstances, in an emergency, we will do that, right? We will find the resources to stretch. And you could say we're in an emergency right now. So for those of us who are trying to do something about it, we could find ourselves in emergency mode all the time. And that's just not going to work for the sustainability of our personal lives and our personal health. So it's tending to that, you know, and it's like being on a tightrope. You have to stay in balance. And when you lean too far to one side, you got to right yourself and get back in balance. So for me, the resourcing comes through a lot of different ways. I like to read novels. You know, a good novel can really resource me. Being outside, taking a walk, being with my family. I live in an amazing community where I get resourced from just the love and support that's here. That's a big resource for me, my family, my partner, and reconnecting with what I'm here to do, which really fuels me because I feel so clear that I chose to come into this time, and there's something that's mine to do, and that I'm asked to do what's mine to do. And if I keep my eyes on that and stop trying to do what's other people's to do, you know, I can't do what is other people's to do, but I can keep coming back to what is mine to do and discerning in any given situation, if I have capacity to give resources and energy into whatever is coming up.
And could you talk a bit more about your community, like Conical Farm? And I suppose you started that, didn't you? And you opened the doors, you know, and it's now such a rich community. So could you talk a wee bit more about that?
Sure. Thank you. So Canticle Farm is really, I say we are experimenting at the intersection of faith-based, social justice-based, and earth-based nonviolent activism. And it's very much influenced by Joanna Macy and the work The Reconnects, and other practices and philosophies as well, including Franciscan spirituality and nonviolence and decolonization, the work of the wilderness guide and psychotherapist Bill Plotkin, nonviolent communication. So all these different tools that come together, dance together, and something wholly unpredictable emerges, which even talking like that, you know, comes from my being influenced by Joanna and the work that Reconnects, being grounded in living systems theory. So Canticle Farm was forming because there was a vision and a dream of it for many years with my husband. And then when it was really forming about 12 years ago, I had been traveling with Joanna for a number of years, just kind of taking in the teachings, like breathing them in. And so in the formation of the community, there was a way I could see the living systems theory kind of happening. And so I had a lot more capacity to just like trust and let things emerge rather than try to over plan or over figure it out. And so we now have 8 houses across 2 streets in a very urban part of East Oakland, but we have a very big garden. So these 8 houses are nestled around a large garden, and there are about 35 people. And we support climate justice activists. We have a house that supports men paroled from life sentences. We have a small sanctuary program supporting people seeking asylum from south of the border here. And we have a food distribution program. And really the thing that's most meaningful to me that we're trying to do here is to heal across the differences of gender and race and class and all of the things that are ripping apart, you know, our planet, but especially here in the United States, where people have lost the capacity to hear each other, and the divisions have gotten so extreme. So it was very important for me to bring practices I had been studying for a lot of years, and also teaching primarily, I would say, nonviolent communication and the work that Reconnects, into an experiment that was living out of those practices day in, day out in a diverse community.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to visit one day.
I'd love that.
I had a member with me this weekend in the form of yourself. Yeah, great. Okay, well, do you have anything else that you want to talk about, Anne, like in terms of the work that you do and or in terms of your experience here in Ireland? Or
thank you for that question. I guess I want to just start by saying there's so much to grieve. And when we find that we don't have the capacity to show up in the ways that we would want to, or, you know, we just find we get up in the morning and it's all too much, and we don't know what to do. I just want to invite that we can slow down and that we can grieve. And in the doing of that, we really find ourselves in that, you know, in that spiral of the work that Reconnects that's so archetypal. Something shifts and we understand ourselves in our larger body, you know, that we can never be separated from, no matter how bad things get. You know, we are members of a living body, and we are Earth. So we are here in this time acting on behalf of Earth. And for me, reconnecting to that purpose just gives me so much energy. And it's connected to, you know, this coming back to the spiral, like choosing to put my attention on gratitude, even if the circumstances seem grim. And then from that place, it's like creating the foundation to stand and be in the pain and the anguish and the frustration and the fury and the anger, knowing that those things are powerful, you know, that they point to what matters to me, that I'm grieving what I love, that I'm my frustration about the injustices is my passion for justice, that my fear actually makes way for courage, and that my powerlessness and uncertainty makes space for something to arise through me and in the context of being connected in the mycelial network of the ancestors, the future ones, the present day humans, and the more than human world, that is going to give me capacity to do things that I can't do alone. So just coming back to the truth of who we are, and working, it's like reweaving to the knowing of who we are, in interconnected and not separate from any of it. That keeps me going. And then in some ways, it doesn't really matter what I do. You know, I really trust that whether I'm working on stopping nuclear weapons testing, which I spent a lot of years doing, or I'm working on supporting people who are in a sanctuary program, or I'm trying to tend, you know, we have so many houseless people here in Oakland living in encampments that are, who are suffering. All of that is around me all the time. And I'm constantly making choices to not tend it, right? I can't do everything, but I'm not asked to. I mean, that's part of the lie of the separate self, that I'm somehow responsible for all that and supposed to respond. And trusting that when I respond and do the piece that's mine to do, that has, you know, that ripples out into the larger body of the web of life and through the mycelial network of care that resources other people and other places. And I have just been so privileged to have a life of a lot of that, you know, in the activism that I've done and the people I've been blessed to get to know and love, including you, you know, the places I've gotten to go. So it actually, it sources me. And I want people to know that's available to all of us, right? It's, you have to put yourself, however, in community, in whatever way that looks for you. It's absolutely true that we can't do it alone. And I can remember hearing that voice, you know, growing up first generation of the feminist movement, where, you know, that voice in my head that said, I can't do this, I can't do this. I mistook that voice as a weak girl voice, that I just needed to stand in my power and, you know, I could overcome and I could do it, you know? So I spent a lot of years, you know, and I guess I would say, okay, the blessing in that was that it shaped and formed me, right? And then about 12 years ago, when I knew that it was mine to do, I was very clear that it was mine to do the fundraising, to help this community come together, like buy these houses and to fix them up. And I thought, wow, I would rather do anything other than that. Really, this is going to be so hard because I have such a hard time asking for help, but much less asking for money. But it was very clear for me that I was supposed to do it. And then I heard that voice go, I can't do it. I can't do it. And for the first time in my life, I realized that if I put one word on the end of that sentence, that it changed everything for me, healed the past, changed the future, and empowered me in the present. And the word, Linda, was alone. And so then I heard myself saying, I can't do this alone. And I understood that that wasn't some weak female voice that needed to, you know, just man up and be strong. In fact, that was a voice of wisdom that was telling the truth of my interconnectedness, that I wasn't some isolated separate self, that I literally couldn't do it alone. Literally, nothing I have ever done has been alone. And so it was like a revolutionary act for me to throw off that concept and say, okay, if I can't do it alone, then what does that mean? Okay, it means I'm going to ask for help. And then I started close in, like David White says, and I just started asking for help from, in a very emergent way. You know, I'd bump into somebody, be like, will you be on my dream team to help me figure this out? And in the process of doing that, I actually asked 14 people and 13 of them said yes. And I realized at the end of that, that I didn't even know what I was asking them specifically to do. And they didn't even know what they were really saying yes to, but they were saying yes to me because they wanted to support me. And that was like the first level of healing. So community is there for us. And when I falter and the wounded parts of me come up and say, oh, you know, you can't ask for help or whatever. I just remember, I go outside and I look around in the garden and I'm so comforted by being reminded that in that ecosystem, the big tall trees are not lording it over the ants. They're not saying we're bigger than you are. We're more important. You know, we have more recognizability. We have more funds. We have a bigger organization. We're more important. We've got more education. And what we do is more important. You know, all of that whole ecosystem is working together to support each other. And of course, it's happening underground as well, you know, in the mycelial network, those, I say people, the more than human world people, you know, the plants and the animals and all of that is in connection and relationship, helping each other out when it's needed. So we're not separate from that. That's us too. And that really rocks my world when I just remember that. And, you know, so, okay, who am I in that ecosystem? What's my job? What's mine to do? How can I do that thing that's mine to do and trust that everything else is here to be in harmony and work together with my role? And that has actually been my experience now for 12 years, you know, in this community. And I keep being awestruck by it. And it's tragic not to know it. I grieve all those years that I really thought I was off on my own and had to be on my own. So we're not going to make it if we don't have that breakthrough. We as a human species, we are not, whatever it's going to look like to go through this great turning and to transition, we know we can't keep going like this. And I would say, you know, the one thing I do know is we can't do this without being in community. So wherever you are, start close in and figure out how to ask one person, team up with one person, and then that will turn to two or three, form those communities. And it's very, very important to know that whenever you have communities of people together, you're going to have conflict, and that conflict can actually be a gift. And we need to bring tools and resources because we've got to strengthen our movements to be able to know how to work across our differences and work with the trauma that's in our system. So we need to tool up around understanding trauma and having tools for conflict. It's like if we were going to go out to build a house, we would first start with a foundation and pour the foundation, and the foundation needs to be to start with what we have, with our capacity, and to build with the tools that we need. So I can say all of this having done it the hard way. And I think that people being born into this time, and I know the young activists in my sphere, in my world, are learning faster and getting the tools faster, and those things are happening around as well. So all of that does, you know, continue to nourish and feed me and leave me feeling, I'll say feeling, optimistic a lot of the time. And I'm glad when that feeling isn't necessarily there that I can choose to put my attention on active hope and to stay the course. Because what else would I want to be doing with my one wild and precious life, as Mary Oliver asks?
Lovely. Oh, thanks so much, Anne. Yeah, you're a real inspiration to me and a teacher as well, you know, so thank you. And thanks for your friendship.
Thank you, Linda. It's been lovely to talk with you.
You too. And thanks to you, our listeners at the ABC's Green Politics. Thanks also to the support from Left Bloc, particularly Trademark and the Creative Workers Cooperative, for helping us put this together. Join us next time as we tackle the letter P. Gara Mayogath.